Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved.
Many storms can form an arch, singly done, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Bricklayers Local 15 and American Federation of Government Employees Local 1336. Since 1865, the International Union of Bricklayers and Allied Crafts Workers has represented the most highly skilled trowel trades craft workers across the United States and Canada. Through local union programs, Back Local 15's apprenticeship and training system is widely recognized for producing highly skilled craft workers. Safety and training are two of BAC's top priorities as well. Build with BAC, that's BAC, Bricklayers and Allied Crafts. Quality is remembered long after price is forgotten. And we are the American Federation of Government Employees, the largest public employee union, proud to make America work, honored to serve the public, and appreciative of the Heartland Labor Forum. We thank our underwriters for their support, the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we'll talk to labor radio producer Rick Smith about his new book, Daddy, What's the Middle Class? It's about a cross-country trip with kids to find out who built America. Then we go to the strike line of port and warehouse workers in California who work for an Amazon contractor. In the news, Grain Valley bans payday lending and on abolishing the tipped minimum wage. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. And now for the news.
The news from our side, October 29th, 2015. Opponents of the astronomical interest rates charged by payday loan companies have tried for years to get some regulation from elected officials in Jefferson City with no success. So now they're moving to the cities. On Monday night, the Grain Valley City Council unanimously passed an ordinance which severely limits areas within the city that have payday loan and title companies. The City Council was responding to clear evidence that such predatory businesses as payday loan companies increase crime and blight. The City Council was acting proactively since Grain Valley does not yet have any payday loan businesses at this time. Grain Valley was well aware that the legislature recently forbid cities to enact ordinances in their own best interest on issues like minimum wage and plastic bag use. So it acted to protect itself from economically destructive businesses like payday lenders and title loan companies before the state could forbid them to do so. Grain Valley joined cities like Gladstone, Independence, Blue Springs in passing ordinances that seek to limit the corrosion caused by such businesses.
There's a growing movement to abolish the tipped minimum wage. Danny Meyer's restaurant chain this week abolished tipping and gave everyone a raise. This month, the New York Times called for the end of the tipped minimum wage in an editorial. Now, the Economic Policy Institute finds that the poverty rate among waitstaff and bartenders is dramatically lower in states where tipped workers must be paid the regular minimum wage as a base wage than in states where restaurants can pay tipped workers a base wage less than the full minimum wage. Federal law permits restaurants to pay tipped workers a base wage of $2.13 per hour, so long as the weekly total of their tips plus the wage base is the equivalent of a week's salary at the minimum wage. If not, restaurants are supposed to make up the difference, but there is much abuse. The separate minimum for tipped employees came into the Fair Labor Standards Act in 1966, when minimum wage protection was extended under the Fair Labor Standards Act to hotels, restaurants, and other service workers who had previously been excluded. The tipped minimum wage has been raised since the early 1990s, a testament to the lobbying power of the restaurant industry. In the states where restaurants are permitted to pay waitstaff and bartenders the federal tipped minimum wage of $2.13 per hour, 18% of these workers are in poverty, more than twice the rate of non-tipped workers in those states. In the 25 states, like Missouri, that require restaurants to pay waiters and bartenders more than $2.13 per hour, but less than the full minimum wage, 14.4% of waiters and bartenders are in poverty, versus 6% of non-tipped workers. The poverty rate of waiters and bartenders is much lower in the 7 states that require restaurants to pay waitstaff and bartenders the regular minimum wage. In these states, it is nearly 8% lower than in the $2.13 states, and over 4% lower than in the states where tipped workers get more than $2.13 per hour, but less than the regular minimum wage. Because the poverty rates of non-tipped workers do not vary between the 3 groups of states, differences in tipped minimum wage policies are likely driving the substantially different poverty rates of waitstaff and bartenders.
CWA Local 6355's Negotiating Committee reached a tentative 3-year labor agreement with the Missouri Department of Social Service and Department of Health and Senior Services last week. Pending ratification, the agreement will cover more than 6,000 social and public health service workers. Natasha Pickens, CWA Local 655's negotiating co-chair, who works as a family service eligibility specialist in St. Louis County, said, "We achieved important gains in protection from discrimination and work rules concerning leave and schedules that will help Missouri state workers achieve a more reasonable work-life balance, and I'm proud of that. CWA members will have to continue to organize our co-workers, though, before we are able to achieve the improvements in our pay and staff levels that Missouri citizens need in order to get quality social services they deserve. The union has been in constant struggle over the last few years against cuts and attacks for the majority in the Missouri legislature. Union members frequently complain about heavy workloads and staff that's hard to the bone."
In These Times reports on the continuing saga of adjunct faculty organizing at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, Duquesne is a highly respected old Catholic university. This article was sent by a disgusted Catholic who commented, "So much for Catholic social teaching on labor rights." This week, the all but one of the adjunct professors at Duquesne English Department were informed that there would be no classes for them next semester. The one adjunct remaining will have one class, and that's only because he's part of a continuing special program. The adjunct faculty at the College of Liberal Arts at Duquesne University have been seeking recognition of their union since they voted for the United Steelworkers in the summer of 2012. The university signed an election stipulation agreeing to abide by the outcome of the election, but then began union busting. They hired the Memphis-based union busting attorney who claimed that as a Catholic university, it is not under the jurisdiction of labor law. The NLRB, however, disagreed and held an election in which the adjunct faculty voted overwhelmingly to be represented by the steelworkers. After another hearing in April, the NLRB reaffirmed that Duquesne was not exempt from labor law, but Duquesne still refused to recognize the union and appealed the decision to the full board. In this appeal, it took a relatively rare approach of including in its legal filing to the board a threat to fire the adjuncts that testified against the university. The union drive was strongest in the English department. The university announced budget cuts, and lo and behold, they fell mostly on English and on the adjuncts. Clint Benjamin, one of the adjuncts who was threatened in Duquesne's appeal on the board and was included in the English department's layoffs, explained that there is no doubt in mind that these firings were due to my and others' vocal union support. Duquesne has been trying to do an end-arounds and manufacturer crisis since they got wind of our efforts. Though the budget cuts were spread across all departments in the College of Liberal Arts, none had similar layoffs. The news tonight was read by Molly Madden,
Ariana
Ariana Eckel, Michael Savoy, and Hester Dusig.
Are forever, said the dog on the tombstone. If you're living underneath the bridge, man, all roads lead to home. I got a hidden flask, I'm paid in cash, got a cross above my bed. You know, I hitchhiked from Chicago, and a man walked up and said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And come to strip our rights away, we'll give you hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line. Today the policeman's a union man, brother firefighter's my friend. And the kids locked in the Capitol are fighting till the end. And we're not gonna break tonight, and we're not gonna bend. Some say the union's down, but I asked around, and everybody said, this is a union town, all down the line. This is a union town, all down the line. And if they come to strip our rights away, we'll give them hell every time. This is a union town, all down the line.
That was This is a Union Town by Mike Tamarill, and boy, that puts me in the mood. This is a great show tonight we're going to have, and we have a special guest, and that is Rick Smith, who makes me really nervous because he is a really, really big radio personality back in Pennsylvania and around the country. Welcome, Mike. Rick, how are you tonight?
I'm good, Hester. Thanks for taking time for me.
Oh, I appreciate the time you've given us because I know you have special obligations this evening.
And it's Halloween here in Pennsylvania, yes.
Do you guys do it twice? I mean, do you have two nights or just one?
No, just the Thursday before the actual Halloween. They want to cut down on mischief, I assume.
Well, good luck on that one. I have to say that I was really interested in the tour. What we're going to speak of tonight is the People's Tour for America, and also there was a book written by Pat LaMarche, and it says What is the middle class, Daddy? Or Daddy, what's the middle class?
Daddy, what's the middle class? It was out of our 2013 People's Tour where we decided we were going to go across country and do a labor history tour. I've got three children, as we kind of talked about with Halloween. And the idea of this tour came out of my then fifth grade daughter coming home from school. And you have those conversations, what'd you learn today? And she said, well, we learned about Rosa Parks. And I said, what'd you learn? She was tired. And I go, that's it? Yeah, that's pretty much it. And it made me go, I'm an experiential learner, so I wanted to take my kids on this trip where we went and experienced history and working history. Interestingly enough, it's simultaneously at the time, you had the History Channel running this TV show, and maybe you've seen it, The Men Who Made America Great, where we had today's Robert Barons telling us how wonderful yesterday's Robert Barons were, how philanthropic they were, and how benevolent they were, and how visionary they were. And all those people who actually did the work, like our grandparents and great-grandparents, they didn't matter. And I wanted to teach my kids something different. So that's what we set out to do. We set out across the country, 9,600 miles in 28 days, and had probably one of the most memorable experiences possible.
I have to ask, as a mom, how old were your children when you did this?
My oldest was 11. My youngest was 5.
Oh.
Yes, we rented a 28-foot RV. We took my wife, my three kids, ages 11, 7, and 5, my producer, my writer, and we hit the road. And it was phenomenal. And you would think that, with all those people crammed into a small space, it'd be tough. It wasn't. It was fantastic. And in fact, we did it again just this year. We did a civil rights tour, though, where we traveled all throughout the South. That'll be the next book.
I was going to say, this sounds great. Are you going to do something like we could put out a call and a whole lot of us could go? We could be a real caravan.
that would be fantastic. In 2017, looking to do another labor history tour just like this, only a little bit more in depth. When you do something, you learn some lessons from it. Mm-hmm. And we learned a couple of lessons, but I want to go back and I want to re-engage the people that we met and meet some new folks. I mean, like in Kansas City, Judy Ansel, really just fantastic human being, gave us probably one of the best tours of the city of Kansas City of anywhere in the country. Took us to the great needle that you guys have there in the park that tells you used to have a garment industry.
Yes.
Kind of reminds me of the Glass Museum in Toledo where they used to make glass, and the soccer team in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, the Steel, where they used to make steel. So we get these monuments and these names to remind us that we used to build stuff.
We did wonderful things. If it was made in USA, you knew it was quality. And when you mention these different things to honor our past works, it makes me really miss them more because, as I told you earlier, I said my grandmother worked in the garment district, and I used to shop down there. We got great bargains, and I wish we had these jobs. And I miss the culture that multi-generational you'd be shared, and like a box plant down there. It was like my mom and all the moms took their kids there for the summer employment so that they could see what it was like to not have any air conditioning. And get burnt on this stuff so that you would, you'd say, I got to stay in school. I'm not going to do this. So I miss those opportunities.
Also, mm-hmm. Pushing that, but also saying that if you do need to get a job and you do need to work, that there's a place for you to be able to support yourself and your family and to have good, decent, honest, hard work that's rewarded. That's something I fear that we're losing, Hester. I think we're losing that idea that you can work hard and you can do manual labor jobs or service jobs and you can still exist and survive and thrive. And sadly, with the assault that we see all across this country on organized labor and workers collectively bargaining, that's one of the things that we're losing.
Oh, I agree, because work was honored. And I remembered my dad, who was an electrician, IBEW 124. He always said, yeah, I don't care what you do. You be the best at what it is. There is honor in all labor.
Absolutely.
And I don't hear that anymore. I hear, I'm not going to work there. I just think because the work isn't valued, that makes the difference. When you went on your tour, which I envy you for going, please tell me, what were, say, three of your favorite cities or the ones that made the most impact on you and your traveling companions?
I think the place that impacted me the most, you go to the iconic places like Chicago, where you go to the Meatpacking District, you go to the Pullman area, which is now going to be a national park. I think one of the and it's kind of weird, I stood on the place where Joe Hill was executed. And, Sugar House Park there in Salt Lake City, where, again, you look at our history and what's happened to workers' history has been, in many cases, eviscerated, and in the rest of the cases, rewritten or hidden. Sugar House Park was one of those places because it still has the arch to the prison, but it's surrounded by like 15-foot-high bushes. So if you don't know exactly where it is, you're never going to find it. And, it's something we learned again and again. And maybe it was right from the start, because we stopped in Martinsburg, West Virginia, to start the tour. And went to the roundhouse there to talk about the Great Railroad Strike of 1877. And we were under the impression that there was a marker there. So we're all over the place looking for a marker. And eventually we found it at the end of an alley up against the railroad track. So in order for you to read what the marker had to say, you had to go into the roundhouse, jump off the platform, walk a quarter of a mile along the railroad tracks, and look up 10 feet to read that the workers destroyed things. It was really just one of those, probably should have been the foreteller of what we were going to find. It was kind of one of those moments. A couple other places we enjoyed. My kid's favorite place by far was Roswell, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Because we talked to an elevator mechanic who could neither confirm nor deny the existence of an escalator to space. So they loved that. Because, when you got kids along, you have to, make some of that a little bit interesting. And, there were just so many places that, you could just go through. Kansas City was a favorite place because of Judy and the tour that she gave. And St. Louis was fantastic because of the people we met there. So to narrow it down, really very difficult. There were a couple of places, though, Hester, that were really very dangerous. And, we can talk about all the fun and all the games, but we went into Blair, West Virginia, and I'm sure you know what happened in Blair, West Virginia, the Battle of Blair Mountain.
Yes.
Where there were a million shots fired in what was really a labor war there. And as we pulled in with our RV and our trailer car, out came the Friends of Coal. The Friends of Coal are a group started by the coal companies that tell the people of West Virginia in that area that any outsiders are coming to take your coal. They're going to steal your livelihood. They're going to steal your jobs. And out they came.
Oh.
And under the guise of they're going to do a roadside cleanup, they came out with their sidearms and their sticks and all of this stuff to just kind of intimidate us. And it was my 7-year-old who at the time questioned them, goes, if you're going to clean up the road, where are your bags? They all kind of looked at each other like, we've been found out by a 7-year-old. But we sent them out of town, and what was interesting about that is, you know, I'm going to get shot. I might as well at least find out why. And we began engaging in a long conversation. And it turns out that most of the people there who were with the sidearms and with the sticks wanting us to leave were people who were having their pensions stolen by Patriot Coal, by people who were having their retiree health care stolen from them by Patriot Coal and Peabody and all of that, and I'm sure you've talked about it.
Absolutely.
But it's one of those things that's just really interesting to me that you're talking about the Battle of Blair Mountain, and they don't want to talk about the history because all they're focused on is the existence and what they've been told, that this is all you have. And what was interesting about going to Blair Mountain is they actually, you go into this place, it looks like a wilderness. They have systematically dismantled this entire community that had 10,000 striking workers, where they were literally dropping bombs from airplanes on these workers. All of it's gone. There's no remnants. And while we were there, they were trying to mountaintop remove the mountain. So not only did they get rid of the town, they wanted to take the damn mountain with them.
Oh, there has been so much going on when it comes to coal. But I have to say, when you went to these cities, and I just wondered, did you find across the board that they didn't really have a good understanding of how we got, how many people had to die and be beat up, and how long we had to fight to get the basic rights that we have now that are just being taken away? Did anybody, are they clueless?
Sadly, I find, unless you're someone who's like me, who's passionate, people like Judy or Larry Spivak in Illinois, or, you know, Roy Gillespie in St. Louis, people who, this is what they do, this is their passion, this is what they wake up in the morning to do. Unless you're there, most people are disconnected from labor's past. We've been told, oh, that was something you needed 100 years ago, and we don't need it anymore. The sad reality is right now, we need it more than ever. And if we're going to change this country and move us forward and do what our grandparents' generation did, create the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization, it comes back to our labor organizations. It comes back to collective bargaining. It comes back to organizing. And to me, it doesn't get any simpler than looking at our history and looking at how much the moneyed interests are putting into destroying it.
You're so right about that. Now, there were families here. My dad was one. He just lectured us on labor history from the time we were little, so it was always, you don't understand, people died. And he would tell stories of it. And luckily, we have Judy Ansel teach. She's professor of labor studies at UMKC. So we have a degree program for that. So we have more educated union people, more educated people about the history. But I just know that there's a real gap, and people are clueless when they're talking about holidays or they're talking about anything. And then it's when you flip it back to them and say, you can thank the unions for that, especially when they're speaking anti-union.
When we were on the tour, we went to West Texas. And if you remember back in 2013, there was a massive explosion at the fertilizer plant there in West Texas.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, blew a hole 10 feet deep, 93 feet around, literally blew basketball hoops parallel to the ground, blew out the backside of a school, knocked a nursing home off its foundation, blew home windows out of homes for miles. If you're going to tell me that we don't need unions, that is a perfect example of why we do. We now find out what caused that 60,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate, illegal to have, in wooden boxes in a wooden shed in the Texas heat with no sprinkler system. Who the cook could imagine something would go wrong. Last time it was inspected by OSHA in 1985. The Attorney General, now Governor, said, well, we don't need regulations, because if you want to know, just go knock on the door and make them tell you. That's why we need labor unions. We need people on the job who are looking at this going, wait a second, this isn't right. You need a voice for first responders who show up and say, we want to know what's in there before there's a problem.
We need people of courage.
Right now, we need those.
Of absolute courage, and not just putting themselves first, because we need leaders. We need leaders, and I think they're out there. We just have to tap into the right ones.
I don't think we need leaders. I think we all need to be leaders.
Oh,
you know,
right.
The one thing the union movement has done is it empowers every worker to have a say. And that's what scares the wealth class of this country. An empowered electorate who says, no more, we're not taking poverty wages. We're not taking 100 CEOs having more retirement wealth than 41% of the nation. We're not taking it anymore. We demand better. That's what they're afraid of, which is why you see the Diane Hendrixes in Wisconsin going, we want right to work, which is why you're seeing all this money going into the No Rights at Work Party, which are telling you workers don't need rights. We need to have that empowered generation, like my grandparents. They wouldn't take this stuff.
Mm-mm.
They demanded better for themselves and their children, and we need to do the same.
Well, and I'm a retired CWA, Communication Workers of America, 6360, and when we had a strike probably about 7 years ago, and it's reality when you have a friend that gets knocked down by a truck driven by a management person who doesn't think she's moving fast enough to get out of his way to get in the driveway. We actually had that happen right in front of us. So it's there. There's the potential for some real violence. We don't want it, but is certainly there, because the respect for workers is just diminishing.
Yeah, I'm with you. And, you know, to go back to the tour, probably the most tragic to me, we went to New York City and the site of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire,
yes.
Which is now part of, it's the Brown Building at NYU,
mm-hmm.
And they were really great about it. They gave us a tour of the building and shared a bunch of history with us. And probably the most tragic was, you know, the guy told the story of a young couple who had just gotten married, who both jumped to their death, and in midair they were kissing before they hit the ground, and their bodies hit the ground so hard that they cracked through the cement. And you go back and you think about why that happened. Because you had the owner class, well, they want people stealing scraps, so we're going to chain the doors shut so nobody can get out. And I remember having the kids, and we're going, you know, this is just a horrible tragedy that you never want to relive. And this was not too long before what happened in Bangladesh.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you think about it, we're reliving history just somewhere else.
Because people aren't educated to know their history. We don't have a lot of time left, and there are a couple of things that I wanted to touch on, and one is that you have your own radio show.
Yes, Rick Smith Show, ricksmithshow.com. All of our podcasts, all of our stuff, you can listen live. You can watch me flail my arms around and rant and rave and go crazy 3 to 6 every day Eastern time.
And I did find that. And also you have labor history in two, is that correct?
Every day we do a two-minute labor history clip so people get a little bit of what we've been talking about. Today, for instance, is the day of the beginning of the Great Depression, the Black Tuesday in 1929, the beginning of the stock market crash, which is kind of interesting looking at last night's debates, because they want to bring back the same policies that caused all of that today.
Oh, that's true. And we... I'm getting signals that I need to hurry up. They don't let me have my whole show. And that is that so people could get some more information about your tour, your trip, because there was a book written. It called Daddy, What's the Middle Class? And
yep.
We will have a link through our site so that people can do it. I know that there's some kind of a contribution for the cause, and they can acquire a book. I think it'd be great. I've got a couple of family members I'd like to get a book for, and I really want to speak to you again when you write your other book about the South.
Anytime, call me anytime. I'd be happy to come and talk with you about anything you want to.
Thank you very, very, very much, and have a wonderful wonderful night of trick-or-treaters. I know you'll enjoy them, and thanks for not leaving the show with us tonight so you can go see the little the little trick-or-treaters coming to your door.
The little ghouls. Thank you so much, Esther.
Thank you very much. Okay, that was Rick Smith, and he can, and this is Hester Dusick, CWA 6360, KKFI, and we want to thank Rick for the time that he spent with us this evening, considering Daddy, What's the Middle Class, and the American tour that they had. They went to like 30 different cities. It was amazing, so I'm actually anxious to find out some more about it. Have
this
a good
is
evening.
Federal worker Cynthia Lee of the Department of Treasury Financial Management Service, and I encourage all of my federal worker friends to support KKFI 90.1 FM during the combined federal campaign. Donating a few dollars each pay period can help keep community radio on the air in Kansas City. Designate your tax-deductible donation to KKFI, CFC Agency Code 21994. Thank you for supporting community radio.
Hello, friends. Tune in on Thursday night at 7 p.m. for the Shots in the Night Halloween special. Don't miss it.
New documents reveal the U.S. drone program's deadly flaws.
Privatization jeopardizes water quality and availability.
Exxon knew climate change was real over 30 years ago.
All that and a summary of the week's underreported news.
On Between the Lines.
Friday morning at 9.
Listen up, we've got a war zone here today right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us, fight back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
You are listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Molly Madden, and I have Barbara Maynard on the line. Barbara is an organizer with the Port Division of the Teamsters International in California. I think mostly in L.A. and Long Beach. Is that correct, Barbara?
Well, I'm actually the National Communications Director for the Port Division. So we are working nationally to try to end the scheme of misclassification amongst port truck drivers, and really leading the way for ending misclassification for all American workers.
Oh, wonderful. That's wonderful. Barbara is pitch-hitting to be our guest because the topic is Amazon, and we had an Amazon worker lined up, but they couldn't make it, and her truckers haul lots of Amazon goods, and they're facing a lot of the same things. And we'll talk about what the truckers are facing, unbelievable conditions just like Amazon workers. I think misclassification was the first thing that they said the Amazon workers in Germany staged a string of one-day strikes from May to December of 2013. And the central issue in the Amazon's dispute with the German labor union has been misclassification of workers. The union said that the warehouse workers should be classified as logistics, not as logistic workers, but as higher paid retail workers. And they allege that misclassification resulting in lower pay is also an issue in the company's U.S. Amazon warehouses. And I think you have that issue too. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That is correct. Although I want to just kind of, it sounds like from what you're saying, the issue in Germany was that they were misclassified as to the type of workers they are. What we're dealing with here in America is a very devious scheme that is one of the major drivers of income inequality in this country, and this is what it is. So companies are deliberately calling their workers independent contractors rather than classifying them as legitimate employees. So they treat them like employees. They control their work. They tell them where to go. They tell them when to go. But what they do is rather than classify them as employees and give them rights to form a union, rights to disability if they get hurt on the job, rights to workers' compensation insurance, all of those things, they call them independent contractors. And because the majority of these workers are immigrants, many of them haven't known how to fight back, and that's where the Teamsters have come in. And so we started, this campaign has been going on for a long time, but a big turning point for us was a couple of years ago when one of our community partners, Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, held a legal clinic for drivers and said, look, you may be misclassified and you may be victims of wage theft. Come in, learn about that, and consider filing what's called a wage and hour claim with the California Division of Labor Standards Enforcement, which is the California's Department of Labor division that handles such things. So that really blew the lid on this, and there are now more than 750 of these wage and hour claims filed with the California Labor Commissioner, and they amount to, on average, $4,000 a month that is being illegally deducted from these workers' paychecks because of this misclassification scheme. And it's just a total ripoff, and it's allowed these trucking companies to really conspire with their giant retail clients like Walmart, Target, Costco, Home Depot, Amazon, of course, to keep the rates that they charge to haul these containers on and off the dock to distribution centers, warehouses, railheads. It's allowed them to keep those rates very, very low, artificially low, because the trucking company almost has no expenses. So this is what the scheme looks like. They charge the trucker to drive the company truck. They charge the trucker for the gas, for the maintenance, for the repair, for the insurance, for the registration. They even charge the driver to park the company truck at the company yard each night, if you can imagine that. And when the driver is sick, if they get injured, if they go on vacation, if they even have any money for vacation, the driver still gets charged for that truck that is sitting idle. So this is a scheme. It's really sharecropping on wheels, and it's absolutely crossed the line in terms of acceptability. And so drivers are rising up, and they are fighting back. And so drivers in Southern California, who really are seen as leading the way for drivers across the country, are currently on their eighth strike, and in the last 2 years since this sort of phase of the fight really began. So they're suing, they're filing claims, and they're striking and fighting back. So it's been a very active campaign.
Did the first step start with them filing for their rights? Because I have a picture of Jose Jimenez, who is a port driver for 10 years. Before being a driver, he was a union welder and earned a fair wage. And he knew something was wrong, I think. And he now works 20 hours a day and almost never has time to spend with his family. Apart from working long hours, it said Jose has to deal with illegal deductions that are made from his paycheck for lease of the company truck he drives and for its maintenance. It is for these reasons that Jose has filed a wage and hour claim and with the California Division of Labor Standards Enforcement in order to regain his stolen wages and change the port trucking industry. Are these most, and this other woman, she'd been there for 11 years and she had children.
Those stories are told day after day after day here. It is the nature of this work, and not only at the ports of LA and Long Beach. You know, 40% of America's goods come through these ports, but this scheme is replicated at every port, every seaport that there is in America. And so yesterday, for example, port truck drivers, very active organizing committee down at the Port of Savannah in Georgia, and they made a demand on one of the companies that drivers are striking here that also has an operation there. They made a demand in support of the drivers here and said, we're next. Drivers at the ports of New York and New Jersey are rising up as well. So the scheme that is here is quite commonplace. It's illegal. It's wage theft. And it is also tax fraud because these companies are not paying their payroll taxes. The drivers themselves are having to pay those. And that's fraud. That's tax fraud. And it is illegal as well.
Now, is this when the company started to retaliate by cutting their hours?
That's exactly right. It's been so difficult for these drivers because when they have filed a claim for wage theft, almost invariably the company retaliates against them in some way or another or in a multitude of ways. at a minimum, they cut their hours, they give them the worst loads. And so there's a very specific impact on them from an economic perspective. But they're also harassing them, intimidating them, and doing almost everything they can to try to get them, frankly, to go away and to leave the company. But these men and a few women, they're quite amazing, aren't backing down. They are not backing down at all. And that's why you've seen them go on strike time and time again. And even though they are misclassified as independent contractors, with the Teamster support, we have gotten them to exercise their rights under the National Labor Relations Act, which consistently only applies to employees. But the National Labor Relations Board has recognized that these workers are misclassified and has agreed to hear these charges, these unfair labor practice charges, and they have ruled on them, effectively saying they are misclassified as employees. So it's a valiant fight.
And could you tell the audience what happened when the longshoremen had a slowdown? What happened to these contracting workers?
Oh, boy, it was very, very difficult for the drivers during the course of the slowdown with the longshoremen, because what happened was goods just weren't moving, so there was not as many containers being taken off the dock. Now, interestingly enough, the unionized, because we do have a few union companies now, the unionized drivers were furloughed, but they were able to receive unemployment like any other employee that is affected by some sort of a slowdown for any reason. Unfortunately, the misclassified independent contractors did not have that opportunity. They're not eligible for unemployment benefits. So they were just simply hurt. So the Teamsters did a lot to try to support these workers, and we've had the Justice Report Drivers Hardship Fund. We've been actively fundraising, and so drivers have been able to come to us, and ask for help paying their rent, making their car payment, whatever the case may be. There was an instance during the middle of that slowdown where one of our just most incredible organizing committee members from XPO Logistics was supposed to go onto the picket line, and all of a sudden, you know, had his hours cut so much, and his wife was about to give birth. She was supposed to give birth after that particular strike that was back in April. And on the night before before the strike was supposed to happen, she went into labor. And he hit the panic button because he realized he didn't have any money for a car seat to bring the baby home from the hospital. He didn't have any money for a crib, and so anything at all. So we all got together, and we had a baby shower for him at the Teamsters local union hall, and we got him everything that he needed. We got everybody to donate, and then the month later, he didn't have enough money to pay his rent, and he and his wife and the newborn son were going to be on the street. So through the hardship fund, as well as through our AFL-CIO Central Labor Council here, where they have a fund in connection with the United Way, we raised money to help him get back on his feet and pay his rent. So, you know, these are incredible. They're survivors. They are fighters, and they are not backing down. And what they're starting to see is justice. We have now four unionized companies, trucking companies, two of which have converted their drivers from independent contractors to employees and agreed to allow the drivers to become Teamsters without a big fight. And we believe that, you know, more are going to be on the way.
Now, were they subtracting money from paychecks even though they weren't working to maintain their trucks or something? Something like
While these men are on strike, the companies are still deducting money from, basically, they're going into debt. So there are many weeks when they have what we call a negative paycheck, where they owe the company. They may have worked 60, 70, 80 hours a week, and then they owe the company for the privilege of working. Can you imagine that?
That's crazy.
It is. It's crazy. And yeah. It's also just blatantly illegal.
Now I want to talk about the strike and how it started. Did it start in L.A. or Long Beach, and how it expanded to the rail?
Sure, the rail yard. So the strike started, this is, as I mentioned, the eighth strike. And the first one was about 2 years ago, and started with one company, and then it grew to another company, and then grew to a third company, and then some of those ended up reaching agreements, and it just continued to grow. In fact, in just a little bit of time here, we may well have drivers from another company go on strike tonight, where I'm waiting to hear in about an hour. So this has really been incredible. And what it is that we've got this office here at the Teamsters Local 848. And on any given day, drivers will literally walk off the street and come in and say that we're fed up, we can't take it anymore. We're ready to stand up and take action. We're going to file a claim. So they file a claim. You know, there's sort of a step to it. And then it, what ended up happening, the reason it spread to the rail, is that one of these companies, XPO Logistics, has a division that goes straight to rail. So those drivers go from the port to rail yards to ship these goods across the country.
They Everything's in a involved. Container now, right?
And now, I'm not sure if you heard about this, but so separately, the next link in the supply chain, if you will, are the warehouse workers, and they are they're employed workers, but they're very, very deeply exploited with terribly low wages, abysmal working conditions. And there's an organization that has been working with them called the Warehouse Workers Resource Center. And on Tuesday this week, Teamster General President Jim Hoffa was out here and at a press conference right there on a picket line and announced that the Teamsters were going to support the warehouse workers in their fight for justice. And so this is really spreading in incredible ways. And we believe that though justice doesn't come fast, that it is coming. And you know, President Hoffa said it himself, that the Teamsters are committed to this fight and we're going to stick with this fight until we win and these workers get justice.
When I read about the Amazon warehouse workers, it's almost ridiculous the way they run the warehouse, because, they walk from 15 to 20 miles a day. They run, really, and they have to pick the items out real fast, and the conveyor belts sometimes are working, and the technicians who tell the company that they need to fix the do a short fix are not allowed, and they wait until the machines are pretty much run dead, and then they move the production to another warehouse. Right. It's just kind of crazy. They're not even using common sense. And the workers don't last long. They have a high turnover.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
You know, Americans don't think about how what they buy in the case of Amazon makes its way to their doorstep in that brown box that we've all come to know so well. And they don't want to know. They just don't want to know how many touches. It's called, in the supply chain, they call them touches. So who touched that package? Mm-hmm. Who touched it when it was coming across the shore? You know, there's been a lot talked about the abysmal working conditions of people in factories in Bangladesh and in China and other places. And, you know, I think people are aware of that, but somehow they're able to kind of shrug it off and say, well, if they were in America, it would be better. You know, that's just because it's overseas. And, you know, price pressures force companies to manufacture goods overseas instead of America. And you know, there's that whole line of thinking that people want to disassociate from reality. And they don't realize what happens once these boxes, once these containers leave the docks. You know, the longshore jobs are very, very good jobs. And they're very fortunate to have had a strong union for so many years. That they do have good middle class jobs with excellent benefits in retirement, but the minute it gets out of the longshoreman's hands, the work falls apart, and it gets into the hands of the truckers, and those workers are deeply exploited, and then it gets in the hands of the warehouse workers, and those workers are deeply exploited, and people are struggling to get by, and you know, the right wing types who were, you know, last night spouting off their venom in the middle of the debate, want to say that these people aren't working hard enough or they should just get an education or somehow there's something wrong with these workers that they're not able to make ends meet when, my God, these are some of the hardest working men and women you could ever imagine. And they have touched not only the box that wraps our Amazon goods, but every single piece that is inside of it. Right. America needs to wake up that this is what is happening. And it's not just fast food workers who are rising up, and it's not just car wash workers who are rising up. These are people who are working hard and just, you know, they're not looking to get rich. They're looking to survive.
Right, right. You know, I want you to give your email so everyone can get online and check this out, okay?
Sure. I urge people to go to our website, which is www.justiceforportdrivers.org. Be sure you put in .org, www.justiceforportdrivers.org. please do go and read up on this. And there is a link there if you're able to donate to the Justice Report Drivers Hardship Fund. Every little bit counts. This is really, you know, a hand-to-mouth campaign, and we're trying everything we can to help these workers, and anything that you can do to help, we would be very, very grateful.
And thank you so much. I'm so glad we got you. Thank you.
Yes, and thank you. Thank you for allowing this story to be told in your city.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara.
Okay. Okay. Bye-bye.
Hi, this is Ginny Ansel with this month's Washington Window on Workers. And with me on the line from Washington, D.C. is Mark Grunberg. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Judy. Hello, everybody.
We want to talk about the candidates with you because you've done a pretty extensive article and review of candidate positions on labor issues. And, you know, I mean, I guess you can start out with the assumption that the Democrats are going to be a little more favorable to organized labor than the Republicans, right?
Yes, I think we can basically sort of dismiss the Republicans, at least for right now, because in a way that's too bad, because as the debates and their positions show, they aren't really listening to workers. They aren't really, talking about what workers want, and that's not good for them, and frankly, that's not good for us as workers either.
One of the really interesting things that you did have about a Republican in this article was about Mike Huckabee and the fact that he thinks that all labor law should be by the states and that there shouldn't be any federal labor law. And, you know, starting it out, of course, he's from Arkansas, which I learned was the first state to pass a right-to-work bill, even before Taft-Hartley in 1944. So you go, Mike Huckabee. Let's talk about Hillary. Okay?
Yeah.
So
she's picking up endorsements. She's on the right side. She's just been a little less specific than the others so far. Now she's going to be rolling out position papers, but she says she's for workers' rights and for labor law reform, but she hasn't been, bang, 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 here's what I plan to do. At least not yet.
Uh-huh.
But as a result of her past stance, she has been picking up endorsements.
Yeah, she just picked up AFSCME's endorsement, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, this week, which is
right,
huge.
And then she picked up the operating engineers yesterday.
Yeah, right. Well, we did a show a few weeks ago about whether unions should even be endorsing at this point. It's so early. But, if she's not giving people any specifics, then are they getting anything for their endorsements?
What they're getting is behind closed doors. She's meeting with union boards, union presidents, union leaders, but not with the rank and file, at least not so far, which has caused some upset in the rank and file, as you can imagine.
Yeah, right. There's a lot of people who are saying, why aren't you endorsing Bernie Sanders? So let's talk about his position.
Yeah.
What is he saying?
Right. Now, he is very, very specific. He is saying we should have comprehensive labor law reform. He's introduced legislation to that effect. Basically, he's reintroduced the Employee Free Choice Act, but with extra teeth in terms of going after labor law violators, higher fines, and things like that.
Mm-hmm. He's also been marching on picket lines, right?
I mean, he was on a picket line with the Verizon workers in New York City this past Monday in Manhattan, and the day before he ran an open letter in Grand Rapids, Michigan, supporting the bus drivers, the Amalgamated Transit Union there, who are battling the bus system. The bus system wants to turn all their pensions into 401k accounts.
Huh.
So
he's also been very, very strong and outspoken about pension reform, right?
Very, very. He is a dissenter on this comprehensive pension reform that passed last year that basically would allow multi-employer pension plans. These are the pension plans that cover things like construction unions, construction workers and construction unions. If those pension plans are in trouble, legislation passed last year that would allow those pension plans to cut present benefits in order to keep future benefits rather than have the plans go in the tank. He says that's unnecessary. He's trying to repeal it.
And we just had a big demonstration here today of Teamsters who are protesting the threatened pension cuts for them. We only have a couple more seconds, really, and I don't want to miss Martin O'Malley. What's he saying that's of note?
Hey, he's saying basically many of the same things that Sanders is. It's just that he's not getting the attention. He also touts his record as governor of Maryland, but he was a very pro-labor governor for 8 years, signed legislation that gave collective bargaining rights to state workers, to home health care workers, instituted enforcement of equal pay and against wage theft, things like that, but he's just not getting any traction.
Okay.
He's got the right stance. He's just not getting any traction.
Okay. Well, that'll do it, Mark. We're out of time. I'm sure we'll pick this up sometime closer to the election, and hopefully we'll have some more specifics from Hillary. Thanks a lot, Mark Greenberg, and we'll talk to you next month. Bye. For the calendar.
Bye.
This is Ariana Echo with the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, October 22nd, 2015. Kansas City Driscoll Berry Boycott Picket on Saturday, October 31st from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at the Costco on Linwood Boulevard in Kansas City, Missouri. Organized by the Kansas City IWW, all Familias Unidas allies welcome. The Student Debt Crisis on Racial and Income Inequality, a panel discussion. Monday, November 2nd from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at the UMKC Royal Hall, Room 104. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee meeting, Tuesday, November 3rd at 6:30 p.m. at the All Souls Universalist Unitarian Church. What's happening in Missouri Corrections? Empower Missouri's First Friday Lunch, Friday, November 6th from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m.
And that's it for the calendar. You can find our calendar on our website, heartlandlaborforum.org. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called The Uber Economy, A Raw Deal, and What's in a Name? Profiling in Hiring. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Mike Murphy, for doing a great job. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special. You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1929. That bleak day is now known as Black Tuesday, the day of the stock market crash that marked the start of the Great Depression. During the optimistic Roaring Twenties, investments in the stock market soared. Between 1924 and 1929, the Dow Jones Industrial Average quadrupled. By 1929, two of every $5 borrowed in bank loans were spent on stock investments. As stock investors overextended themselves, they failed to read troubling economic signs. Farm communities were sliding into an economic depression. Consumer credit was reaching unsustainable levels. The first signs, or trouble, began on Black Thursday, October 24th, when the market lost 11% of its value. Then on Monday, it slid another 13%. By Tuesday, the market opened in a melee. In the first 30 minutes, 13 million shares were sold. At the time, stock transactions were recorded on ticker tape. According to Time magazine, by the end of the panic-filled day, 15,000 miles of ticker tape had been printed. The final totals were devastating. The market had dropped another 12%. Stocks continued to fall over the next few weeks. In all, $25 billion was lost. That equals more than $300 billion in today's money. The events of 1929 signaled the beginning of a global economic depression. The depression was devastating for working people. Before the depression, there were 25,000 banks in the United States. By 1933, 11,000 of them had failed. Families saw their entire life savings wiped away overnight. Unemployment soared to 25%. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt implemented his New Deal policies to put people back to work. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.